believe it's $150 level donation to get yourself a library of Alan Watts, and also we have a $100 levels, a $50 levels for Alan Watts material. You can call 818-985-5735 and get yourself something there. Of course, you can pledge for Think Outside the Cage, even though we weren't able to hear that today. They just had some issues on their side, and they weren't able to come by. Hope they're doing okay. So next week, we will have a Think Outside the Cage. But hey, if you call now and pledge and say, hey, you know what? I want to pledge for Think Outside the Cage. You can do that, and that'll give them the that love. So 818-985-5735, they'll get that credit for you pledging your support for Think Outside the Cage, or just pledge for this radio station. It's a great show. Also, this is a great radio station. We need to stay on the air, and times are now that you get involved. 818-985-5735. Let's go to the next program, 10 o'clock. Once again, www.kpfk.org. Beneath the Surface starts now.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I am producer-director Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman. We are not even 2 weeks into the new Trump administration, and it has already been a horrifying whirlwind of attacks on immigrants, transgender people, tribal nations, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and women's rights, as well as dismantling government institutions at the highest level. It's coming almost too fast and furious to fathom. And make no mistake, these shock and awe actions are designed to keep people in fear and paralyzed as Trump and the overt fascists around him are staging what is being called an administrative coup. Our guests today, David Cobb and Kali Akuno, are some of the few who saw this moment coming years ago and have never stopped organizing against the fascist threat, organizing nationwide to build the People's Network for Land and Liberation and a programmatic approach to overcoming fear through clear analysis, organization, and direct action to not only resist, but build real infrastructure to keep people safe, meet basic needs, and cultivate both the idea and practice of political and economic democracy on a mass scale. As the Italian anti-fascist Antonio Gramsci said, "The old world is dying and the new struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." And for David and Kali, as well as myself, the way through is not only fighting the monsters, but bringing that new world into being. We'll spend the hour with our guests discussing the nature of this current historical conjuncture and what they have been doing to prepare the people for this very moment. All this when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm producer-director Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman. We are recording this on the 12th day of the Trump administration, and the nation is reeling from a flurry of executive actions that have already caused catastrophic effects throughout society. Even listing them all might take up half this episode. But among the hundreds of actions taken in the first 2 weeks, Trump has challenged the 14th Amendment by attempting to end birthright citizenship, ordered a slew of ICE raids in schools and workplaces, gutted government resources for LGBTQ plus and HIV care, revoking passports of transgender people, attempted to freeze all federal funding affecting hundreds of millions of people who rely on federal programs for jobs and services, withdrew from the Paris Climate Agreement and the World Health Organization in the face of an impending bird flu pandemic, gutted the FAA days before a disastrous plane crash in D.C., caused by understaffing of air traffic controllers and not DEI, as Trump claimed, fired top leadership at many federal agencies, including the National Labor Relations Board and EPA, as well as essential fiscal operations at OPM and OMB, placing them under lackeys handpicked by Elon Musk, announced his intentions to expand Guantanamo Bay into a massive concentration camp for up to 30,000 people. There's an imminent shutdown of the CDC, and as of this recording, he is set to impose high tariffs on imports from Canada, Mexico, and China, raising consumer prices, which will have a huge impact on an already precarious economic situation for millions of working people. It's coming, almost too fast and furious to fathom, and make no mistake, these shock and awe actions are designed to keep people in fear and paralyzed, as Trump and the overt fascists around him are staging what is being called an administrative coup. The neoliberal center of the Democratic Party has all but collapsed in the face of this assault. Trying to muster some resistance to the institutional dismantling of the government on a legal level, but in the case of the Lake and Riley Act, even helping Trump's anti-immigrant agenda, with 12 Democratic senators and 46 representatives voting in support of the act, which further criminalizes undocumented workers. So what is to be done in the face of this highly accelerated fascist threat? For my guests today, as well as myself, the answer has always been to prepare the people. Prepare the people for crisis. Prepare them to not rely on institutions that are sinking fast. Prepare them to not only resist, but build the foundation for a better, more truly democratic society in which the very idea of fascism could never take root again. And what's even better, our guests have been embedded in real praxis towards making this happen. So let me introduce them and we'll get into this very important conversation. David Cobb is a people's lawyer who has sued corporate polluters, lobbied elected officials, run for political office himself, and has been arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience. He serves as co-coordinator of the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, and he is on staff with the People's Network for Land and Liberation, and he was the Green Party nominee for president in 2004. We also have Kali Akuno with us today. Kali Akuno is a co-founder and director of Cooperation Jackson, which is an emerging network of worker cooperatives and supporting institutions. Cooperation Jackson is fighting to create economic democracy by creating a vibrant solidarity economy in Jackson, Mississippi, that will help transform Mississippi and the South. You can find more information about Cooperation Jackson at cooperationjackson.org. Kali served as the Director of Special Projects and External Funding in the mayoral administration of the late Chokwe Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi. His focus was on supporting cooperative development, sustainability, human rights, and international relations. Kali Akuno is an organizer, educator, and writer for human rights and social justice. He is a former co-director of the U.S. Human Rights Network. Kali also served as the executive director of the People's Hurricane Relief Fund based in New Orleans, Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina, and was a co-founder of the School of Social Justice and Community Development, a public school serving the academic needs of low-income African American and Latino communities in Oakland, California. Kali is also the co-editor of a great book that everyone should go out and check out, Jackson Rising, The Struggle for Economic Democracy and Black Self-Determination in Jackson, Mississippi, and is the author of numerous articles and pamphlets, including the Jackson Cush Plan, Until We Win, Black Labor and Liberation in the Disposable Era, Operation Ghetto Storm, Every 28 Hours Report, and Let Your Motto Be Resistance, a handbook on organizing new African and oppressed communities for self-defense. I also want to mention a really, really exciting new webinar series at cooperationjackson.org, which starts on Tuesday, February 11th. This will be a monthly webinar series that will be going throughout 2025, and it's on the build and fight formula. This is this approach that we'll be talking about on the show today. The monthly webinars are organized around practices of position and then practices of maneuver. That will be streaming live on cooperationjackson.org and social media channels. I would absolutely check it out if you like this conversation today. Welcome to the show, David and Kali.
Thank you, Mel. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Definitely a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to familiarize our listeners with each of your journeys towards this combination of theory and practice you are both engaged in now. I met you both around 2016, 2017, during that chaotic election and the advent of the first Trump administration. And it was interesting how back then we all kind of sort of held the mantle along with a lot of our comrades of being premature anti-fascists. I want the listeners to understand how each of you got to your understanding of where we were headed and then how you both arrived at and converged on this idea and approach to resist and build. So, Kali, let's start with you. As a co-founder of Cooperation Jackson and an organizer with the Malcolm X grassroots movement before that, you've already been working for decades for Black liberation and on the kernel of what you now call the build and fight formula. How has this evolved through your understanding as well as the profane process of history, as Marx would put it?
Well, let me try to tell a long story in a very short, condensed way. For me, explicitly tracking neo-Confederate and neo-fascist and outright fascist forces starts in the early 1990s, when I was getting trained and became a trainer in the shortwave radio community building movement. And once I became a trainer, and this is in the early 90s, 93, 94, around that period, the courses that I was a part of, that were set up by a network of folks who were doing training primarily in the Western states. So California, Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, in the main. It just became very evident to me that there were just skinheads and Aryan nations and, just neo-Nazis who were the primary folks who were taking these trainings. And I got into this to like try to, bring some skill and communicative network to Black communities, Black and Latino communities, where I'm from in California, and create our own kind of independent networks where we can share information, share news, do political education. And I just became overwhelmed by how few of our people were showing up and how deep the white supremacists were showing up. And I just started monitoring, right? I was still teaching courses and just straight up teaching courses to Nazis, straight up teaching courses to skinhead on how to set up and to do the shortwave radio. And from that, I just started monitoring as best I could their activity and taking them and what they said very seriously and what they wanted to do. Started reading their propaganda and materials. And it was from that I just learned, very quickly in the 90s that this was a growing movement, a dynamic movement, and that it was gaining ground towards the mainstream of the Republican Party and the right. And you can just see it steadily in terms of, if you knew where to look and where to trace. And I saw the beginning of what wound up being kind of the Fox News network formula being perfected in low wave radio networks in the 90s, right? And how the format that they used to just propagandize so well on Fox, that started in community radio, moved to commercial radio, and then moved to Fox. So just in the tracking is where I started to take them seriously and to believe them when they said that they intended to, shrink the federal government, go after minorities, and reshape American society. And every election fundamentally since Newt Gingrich got elected, which I would say was the beginning of this modern term, but it goes back even further to really the Goldwater Revolution, if we're being quite frank and candid. But ever since then, I've been on a serious quest to just try to educate as many who dared to listen, cared to listen, to pay attention, that these forces were gaining ground. They were taking over many of the institutions of the conservative movement, and I make a distinction between their movement and the conservative movement, although now they basically dominated that space, to say that this was coming, and they have been openly talking about and planning for civil war, and if, not just only planning for it, but trying to agitate and bring it about to reshape society. So that's where my journey really began, I would say in 92, 93, 94, where my own consciousness started to crystallize around this. And ever since, I've been trying to find some way not only to defend the communities in which I work and live, but to educate as many folks as possible that we need to get our act together, take them seriously, and be prepared not only to fight back, but to do our own transformative work in our communities.
Awesome. Thank you, Kali. David, let's go into your story. I know I'm a small part of that probably, and we came together. I met David. We were both working on the Stein-Baraka campaign in 2016, and with just full disclosure, and we also worked on the Movement School for Revolutionaries after that, which I'm sure you'll get into. All right, David, let's hear from you.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to do the same thing that Kali Akuno did, which is to try to condense what is a really a long story into a short narrative. And for me, it goes like this. I was born in rural poverty in Texas. I had the good fortune to be raised by a mama and a mama and papa who really took good care of me and helped me to be a loving, good person. In poverty, what I saw, lived experience was that The idea of economic meritocracy was BS. I knew that that was not true because it was my lived experience. But because I'm a white, cisgendered, male-bodied person, the rest of the creation myth of this country being about justice and liberty and such, I bought that. And I really actually believed it up until, and then right out of high school, I went into construction for a couple of years. Realized that would make a young man old quick. And so I started at the University of Houston in the 1980s and immediately got involved in the anti-apartheid movement there as a student organizer because it was very painfully clear to me what apartheid was and how horrific it was. And I still remember, and I'm going to tell this story on myself real quick, arguing with the first actual organizer I ever met in my life, who tried to tell me the US government supported apartheid. And I remember as a young, what, 19, 20-year-old fella, man, this is America. We are the good guys. And that fella didn't ridicule or mock me, but actually helped me to understand and stayed with me. And of course, by the end of that semester, I'm on the other side of the table and knee-deep in the anti-apartheid movement myself. I tell that story on myself to remind myself to stay humble because I don't know what I don't know, and neither do your listeners. Nobody does. The 1990s, it was very obvious to get, from that, it was the Jesse Jackson for president campaign in 84 and 88, Jerry Brown in 92. In the 1990s, I was very active in the global justice movement. Like Kali, had a taste really early as a concert promoter locally, and we would do a lot of skinhead shows. And it's worth pointing out that in that time, there was a big distinction. There were explicitly anti-racist white skinheads, and there were explicit fascist skinheads. And when you would do a show, it would not be unusual for fascist Nazis to come in. And I learned very quickly that with genuine actual fascists, either they drive you out or you drive them out. There is no negotiating. There is no finding common ground. There is no respecting differences. So that lived experience really helped me. And I also want to lift up, I stumbled upon a website called Stormfront, where they were, as Kali said, very clear, very explicit about what they were actually doing. And so I, like him, began to track it then. In 2000, I managed the Ralph Nader for President campaign in 2000, ran for president myself on the Green Party ticket in 2004. I will say in 2007 and 2010 was on the National Planning Committee with Kali Akuno for the United States Social Forum that convened first in Atlanta and then in Detroit, Michigan. Worth pointing out that when we were gathering literally 20, 30,000 people in those two places, literally the weekend that we were in Detroit, a couple of hundred folks got together and formed the Tea Party. And of course, the Tea Party got all of the publicity, not just on Fox News, but in so-called mainstream media, and I'm going to say it, in progressive media as well. Pacifica Network was a notable exception, so shout out to Pacifica. But the reality is, almost nobody was tracking the people's movement that was already organizing. As you pointed out, Mel, in 2016, I had the honor of managing the Stein Baraka campaign. Mel Figueroa was the press secretary for that campaign. And I'm going to conclude it with this. Mel, I give you a lot of credit for helping me rediscover Antonio Gramsci and look at this historic moment as the conjuncture that it truly is. Those Movement School for Revolutionaries that you and I did traveling around the country, trying to tell people to prepare for what we saw coming, was instrumental in the current work that I do. And when we went to Jackson, Mississippi, and did a Movement School for Revolutionaries with Kali Akuno and other comrades at Cooperation Jackson, that inspired me to say, time to stop traveling around the country trying to prepare people and say, I need to dig in the way they have done in Jackson, in my community here in Humboldt County, California, and replicate that. So, again, I want to give you, Mel, without embarrassing you, but to say I give you a lot of credit for helping me see the fascist threat was accelerating more quickly than I realized. And so I will conclude this. I am not shocked by Trump because it was predicted. I am awed at how effective he is being this time as opposed to the first administration.
Awesome. Thank you, David. And I will let listeners know the Movement School for Revolutionaries. I think the website might still be up. I know the Facebook account is. Yeah, David and I started doing that. I will say when we're recording today on Saturday, February 1st is the 8th anniversary of when I was at Berkeley and Milo Yiannopoulos came to the campus and we had a very dramatic show of beating them back. And that started a lot of what inspired that movement school as well. Seeing not just how the fascists were kind of coming in to college campuses around the country. And I was organizing with other faculty at the Campus Anti-Fascist Network then, but also how a lot of, people who considered themselves good liberals, a lot of the mainstream media, a lot of folks turned their backs on us, frankly. And, we're not prepared to understand the threat that is now coming down. So now that we're here at the moment when it is really coming down in a big way, I'd like to hear from you both, sort of going into the current historical conjuncture. We're at a very crucial moment of time and where these actions are coming fast and furious. But how do you see the current moment, just sort of like, proximally? How did we get here? What are the balance of forces that you see at this current conjuncture?
Well, I'll start. We get here. That part I think we need to tell and tell more detail. We get here because of the profound shifts that particularly American capital unleashes upon the world in the late 1960s, 1970s, which wind up ushering in the era called neoliberalism. Now, everybody just be mindful that neoliberalism is just one particular sets of strategies and programmatic kind of tactics, if you would, of the capitalist world system. So it's nothing different than capitalism. It's just a particular way by which capitalism chooses to extract and exploit. And that comes into kind of full force on the heels of the US kind of overplaying its hand, overspending, etc., in the Vietnam era, wherein Nixon winds up eventually in 73 taking the US dollar off of the gold standard, quote unquote, letting it float and then moving it to kind of a petrol dollar. But with that, basically upending the Bretton Woods institutions. That's the IMF, the World Bank, and what would become, it was called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade then, but what would become the WTO. Now, why do I cite this? Because what you wind up having, particularly in the West, is a deep stagnation, particularly amongst wages and living conditions amongst working class people across the board, much more severely, for black and brown folks, but also in the United States and parts of Europe for the white working class. And in corresponding fashion, you wind up seeing record-breaking profits from, global multinational corporations and CEOs, till you get to the point now with in some place like the United States, what is it, 500 to 1, in terms of your average kind of CEO to relative pay of a average kind of wage worker in their companies, just something to the extreme. So the wealth gap has increased, the opulence has increased, the decadence has increased, but the standards of living have declined, but they've been able successfully within that to just wage some very effective, what they call cultural wars. And these culture wars are always, particularly in those same two areas, very good at blaming down and displacing kind of frustration onto petty kind of competitions, primarily amongst different communities, blacks against Latinos, quote unquote, or Latinos against black. Men against women, there's too many women in the workforce, etc., as opposed to looking at the real fundamental changes. When you put these two together with the vicious and inherent combination of racism that comes with settler colonial societies like the United States and global empire, you get a very dangerous mix of particularly white working class people and white petty bourgeois professionals trying to make sense out of the world and their place within it in a way that they feel that they can have some agency. And since they have not had an orientation, and no one's fundamentally pushed them because of how devastated and weak and kind of utterly eviscerated the left has been in the United States, really since the 1930s. There's no counter narrative. There's no real counter practice or examples that folks can look at. And so the answer winds up being, you know, your problem, as we saw, like, as you brought up, Mel, the problem is not that there are not enough air traffic controllers. The problem is that we've hired too many blacks and women and disabled people who actually have nothing to do with who was flying those planes or who was navigating them whatsoever. But that becomes the easy and convenient answer that folks can point to as to why, you know, kind of, as David mentioned, as a cis white man, I'm not what I was told should be my birthright or my right place. And this grows to kind of what people are calling the grievance politics that you see on full display. There's more I can say, but I just want to paint a picture fundamentally about the root of this being the massive adjustments to the capitalist system itself and the fact that the capitalist order is not being able to operate by the normal rules of operation to guarantee the benefits that it once offered to working class, particularly white working class workers in the United States, in Canada, in Western Europe. And what has emerged is a right-oriented grievances policy, which speaks to, you know, real frustrations with the declining standard of living, but a number of profoundly displaced anger and frustration where folks are blaming down as opposed to blaming the actual capitalist class, the actual corporate rulers who are manipulating all the different levers of power in order to try to extract and exploit at levels that they find acceptable, which are utterly egregious. And another piece to add on that, are destroying the planet as we speak. And we'll hopefully get into that a little bit more. But they're on a fast march, you know, to kind of put us all in our place, all those who have some kind of degree of melanin in our skin or who aren't heterosexual or heteronormative, you know, who have vaginas. They have a very definite placement of where they want us to kind of get back in the world as they saw fit before the profound changes of the 20th century with the advent and adoption of civil and human rights in most societies.
Well, first, no notes to Comrade Akuno, but I will take another spin at it. And I'll say it this way, y'all, like the conjuncture that we're in is a global one, which is to say we are in the midst of a global ecological collapse. It's not coming, it's here and accelerating. And all of the inherent contradictions of capitalism are becoming untenable, which means that even if there was some technological save for global climate crisis and energy, et cetera, which I do not believe is possible, but even if that was true because of automation, robotics, technology, now artificial intelligence, capitalism, as we have understood it, is morphing into a new era, what many are now calling, and I think correctly, techno-feudalism. And that is creating the conditions of fascism. And fascism is not merely jackbooted thugs and cops beating up and killing black and brown-bodied people and transgendered and other queer people. That's horrific. But fascism specifically is a way to organize the entire society. It actually requires a mass movement to do so, which Kali, I think, very accurately pointed to. So this is why there is a global fascist movement happening all across the country. It's always nationalistic. And in the U.S., it's always white supremacist. But there are brown and black skinned fascists all across the country because they're doing their version of it, which is always about the us versus them and the punching down that Kali so accurately described. So for me, I want to be explicit and clear. The only way to defeat fascism as a mass movement, and this is a hat tip to Mel Figueroa, who taught me this phrase, the only way to really defeat fascism is to create and build a society where the seeds of fascism cannot take root. And that's, I hope, what we'll get to in the next part of this conversation.
Awesome. Thank you, David, and thank you for the shout out. It's a lesson hard learned. And of course, the other phrase that I want to put out here for the listeners, as well as, you know, folks who are concerned, is that the minimum fascism requires is for people to do nothing. Like, don't be paralyzed, like, get out there and protect your communities. Thank you for that, David. And yeah, you brought up two very important topics that I think are, in fact, kind of unique, shall we say, to this 21st century iteration of fascism. Then the first is climate change. Of course, this is going to be airing in LA just a couple of weeks out from the most devastating fires the city has seen, destroying Pacific Palisades, as well as the historic Black community in Altadena, which, Kali, I know you're very familiar with as well. And I'm here in Northern California, where in a county where four of the five largest wildfires have burned through communities. There's so many places in the country now that are places of climate refugees, people who have been displaced, people who have been affected by climate-related disasters. And, you know, this enhances the crises and makes the actions and the fascist push in an era where the climate conditions cannot hold society as it is. It's a huge thing, and yes, something new because of where the world is. So I'd love to hear from you about how the climate crisis is really figuring into this, not just on a, you know, Trump letting the oil and gas things going in, and not just on that administrative level, leadership level, but also within society. How do you see this playing into where we are, as well as what is to be done about it?
Good question. Let's tag team this a bit, maybe some back and forth here, David, but I will start that. I want everybody to remember Elon Musk's crazy idea about building life tunnels in Los Angeles, since you invoked Los Angeles and the fires that just took place there, some of which I understand are still actually ravaging now in certain parts of Southern California, and his constant promotion not just to sell rockets in space tourism, but his whole notion that humanity is under grave threat. And in order for the human species to survive, some portion of humanity is going to have to not only move to Mars, but colonize Mars. And that the part of his whole SpaceX program is supposed to be this futuristic, capitalistic endeavor to have humankind avert the climate calamity and reach new heights and survive. Well, he's not alone in that, right? Let's remember, just in the last 4 years, we've seen a billionaire after billionaire build, you know, these spaceships and, you know, giant space dildos that some of them constructed, you know, to try and go to the moon or to asteroids and comets for mining them. And if you listen to Bezos, to cite another one, he wants to colonize the moon and turn the earth into a nature reserve, fully devoid of humans or a good number of humans. Now, let's step back and look at, you can say this is tongue in cheek, but let's look and listen to the implications of what's being said. The basis of it is that they are fully in agreement and alignment and complete understanding that, as David mentioned, climate change is here. Not something that's coming, it's here, it's advancing, it's accelerating. They are very clear. They are not going to stop what they are doing in the least in terms of extracting from this planet and aggravating all the different triggers, you know, in terms of global emissions, destroying ecosystems, species extinction, etc. They're not going to stop what they're doing. And they're trying to blame that and put it off on, you know, broad humanity. But they're not going to stop, have no intention on stop. And they see that the only solution is a massive depopulation when you really get the underneath of what they're saying. Some of us said it's outright that about 6 billion people need to go in order for humanity to kind of survive with ecological limits. But they're not planning on saving humanity. If you listen to like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who I think is put it most eloquently, if you can get to Mars and terraform Mars with all of the resources and technology and technical expertise that would take, you can fix Earth. So there's a deliberate choice not to address transforming Earth or repairing or healing Earth or making it regenerative, because it would be contrary to their business model, their way of life in the very capitalist system itself. And so instead, they'd rather promote wars, conflicts, aggression, and this hyper move to the right to punish humanity or to get folks to disappear or outright eliminate a good number of people on the planet in order to move their agenda forward. And I'm glad that David invoked this whole notion of techno-feudalism, that there was a good 1-2 piece that we played there, because I fundamentally believe that is where we are at, not where we're headed, but where we are fundamentally at, given this new kind of era of where, what capitalism has morphed into in this new kind of phase, and then what the consequences of that are. And one of the core consequences, I think, as we see on a global level, you have to have the fascist order of capitalist governance in order for this program to fundamentally work. That is where we're at, and it's how these two are deadly linked and how they're going to continue to be advanced and promoted. So don't get confused by battery-operated cars and electric cars, you know, that Tesla is doing. He has no interest, and him and the class have no interest, which is why they are so aligned with Trump and his burn, baby, burn agenda and the continued the petrol kind of oil industry. They have no intention on stopping or doing anything to try to reverse climate change at this particular point in time. This is a smash and grab. They're going to grab whatever they can, take whatever they can, possess whatever resources that they can, hoard them, seal them off to the greatest extent possible. And, you know, from their perspective, if they can leave and go to the moon or Mars, they will. But they're not planning on including me, you, or anyone else within this listening audience.
So I'm going to pick up the baton and really be clear. So I agree with everything Kali Akuno has just said, and I want to put a fine point on it. It is not merely the climate catastrophe. It is literally the entire ecological collapse, because capitalism, which commodifies Mother Earth, is now accelerating because of the technology. We are commodifying Earth at a pace that has never been seen before. Mother Earth cannot replenish herself. We are watching the end of the current system. But I don't celebrate it, because I see the techno-feudalism that has already begun, and it too will accelerate. I guess the one thing I want to underscore is the current system is dying. So I'm not fighting to save this dying system. I'm fighting to create a new one, or better still, to return to the balance that existed before capitalism, before the enclosure movement, before imperialism, the way the indigenous worldview of being in balance that every human being ancestors once knew, to be in right relationship, not only with other humans, but with Earth herself.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, I just want to also, I mean, I'm sure we've had several shows on this program talking about traditional ecological knowledge, talking about indigenous relationship with the world. And to, you know, just for our listeners to understand too, because there's a whole like story in society that, you know, life before industrial capitalism was just nasty, brutish, and short. You know, you have a lot of folks talking about this, oh, there's just going to be wars over resources, and just repeating the prejudice that we've been taught that pre-colonial societies were, you know, Stone Age, prehistoric, and that to adopt any part of that, going back to some kind of imagined caveman existence or something like that. I mean, there's that bias. And, you know, one of the things I have learned over my many years of working with indigenous communities is that these lands were lands of abundance before industrial capitalism devastated lands around the world. And so it is possible to live in abundance. It is possible that we don't need capitalism, or actually we should actually just overcome it, right, in order to bring it into balance. But this thing that you're both highlighting about techno-feudalism is incredibly salient in this moment, where Elon Musk is literally taking the reins of the government's fiscal system. Like, literally the government agency that writes the checks is being taken over by Musk lackeys. And then we also have this this battle now, this global battle over AI, and which, you know, the release of DeepSeek, the sort of on the cheap 50 times better AI model that China put out, which of course is not ecologically viable either. But what it revealed, I think, was just the dependence of the US economy on technological primacy and what they were hoping to do in the AI field. And Trump even signed an executive order protecting the US's primacy in this field. Kali, I know you've referenced many times a really deep cut Dune reference, which as a sci-fi fan, I really appreciate. And that's Butlerian Jihad, which for the record has nothing to do with either Islam or Judith Butler. But if you want to talk about that, we're going to pivot right now to like kind of what you all are doing, what needs to be done, how we extricate ourselves from this 21st century Gordian knot. So let's go from there and then go into the grassroots infrastructure that you all are building and hope to build and are starting to build at scale.
Let me start with the Butlerian Jihad piece. I would encourage everyone to do a deeper dive in the work of Frank Herbert and Dune. The Butlerian Jihad is a term that comes out of his work, a concept that comes out of his work, wherein he envisioned a world wherein what we would call AI, what he called thinking computers, had taken over the kind of vast expanse of humanity in his books. By that time, humanity expanded to large sections of our galaxy. And these computers took over, and for a period of time, they got to a period where they were basically running all of society and dictating to humanity what humanity would do and start enslaving large sections of humanity. And there was a revolution to move them, to displace them from controlling humanity. That's what's called a Butlerian Jihad. And that ushered in this kind of a new era where humans had to kind of perfect their own skills and talents in order to do the things that they were dependent upon machines doing. So intense calculations, for instance, for space travel and managing society, et cetera. But I want you to read it, not just because of that. That's a particular novelty. But I think, you know, why I've been getting into it so much the past couple of years, I read it as a kid and it interests me, always was dear to my heart. But I think he was onto something deeper about how the present era, and he was writing this primarily in the 60s, 60s and 70s, how we look, when we look at, you know, a Donald Trump, or we look at Erdogan, or a Modi, or I can go on and cite many, but when we look at how this fascist order is being kind of organized, and you got folks, intellectual folks, who are now even openly arguing, getting printed in the New York Times and the New York and mainstream press, arguing that we need to return to monarchy and just call it a questionable, and this becoming mainstream currency. We're moving back towards this feudal era that I think Yanis Varoufakis, who kind of coined the term techno-feudalism, kind of harking to. And I think this book, the book series and the work that he was underscoring leads us in this direction to provide us an analysis of what we need to do and to come back to this reference upon how do we perfect our skills as human beings and make deeper connections within that to liberate ourselves. Now, there's some aspects about, you know, the breeding program and stuff of like the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. I'm not an advocate of that. But I do think in some of the work that we've been trying to do in PNLL, we're trying to harken back towards what can our communities do with the resources and skills and talents that we have that don't necessarily require huge amounts of capital infusion and definitely don't require the permission of those who would be our overlords to kind of execute, to build a transformative program in our local communities based upon local connections, local care work, and enhanced productivity in local scales, and in deep democracy in local scales. This is what, you know, with Cooperation Jackson, we call the Build and Fight Program. I've adopted an extension of that within PNLL. And it fundamentally entails, you know, starting with mutual aid, social reproduction and care work as a base level of connection that we want to make to reinstill solidarity within our communities, connections within our communities, and meeting each other's fundamental needs, but also, you know, coming up with a clear determination of what each other needs so we can try to produce for it. And that leads to the second point, which is dependent upon a program around land decommodification, if not decolonialization, as a further step, ultimate step. For us, it's a way to get to building a program of food sovereignty, right? Starting with producing enough for food security in our communities, but getting to a level where we are producing the essential foodstuffs and required pieces that we need to ensure the stability of our communities and make sure that everybody has enough food. And we can do that within the abundance that you've spoken to, Mel, around really learning our bioregions and what they can do and sustain in order to build a program of regeneration, regenerating our soils, replanting, you know, kind of a native flora and fauna to do the deep healing that we need, and put ourselves in the right perspective as a second piece of that. And then the other core components are doing the worker self-organization on a mass scale. If that's, you know, building trade unions to have more aggregate power, to ultimately kind of take over various corporate entities or build new cooperatives so that we collectively manage work together and build it out. These are core components. And then the critical piece that we were adding is this critical piece around digital fabrication, right? Community production is what it is. And that is taking some of the more advanced technology that has kind of emerged the last 40, 50 years, putting it to communal use, subjecting it to communal kind of control and dictates, and doing, utilizing what we call appropriate technology to produce for communal needs. Use value exchange ultimately is what we're looking at to eliminate all of the excessive waste that comes with the mass Fordist-based production that capitalism has kind of been centered around for the last century. But it all ultimately has to come together with broad democratic practices. So planning councils and people's assemblies, this is what we're trying to build out in all the different nodes of the People's Network for Land and Liberation. And I just tried to give it to you in short, a succinct order. But we definitely encourage folks to take this up. And we know that there are elements of this that are being practiced everywhere, particularly since the pandemic, as folks are trying to meet their needs. One of the critical pieces we want to do is promote this, demonstrate it in practice, and have folks ally with us and federate with us to build on the ground bioregional alternatives that can link up and create a new society. That's what we're aiming to kind of meet this moment, meet this threat head on, in a way that's going to meet our actual material and social needs.
Thank you, Kali. And I want to point listeners to a couple of resources that, you know, if you want to get deeper into this analysis and this program, there is a Build and Fight webinar series conveniently arranged around the Gramscian concepts of practices of position and then practices of maneuver. And that starts on February 11th. And you can go to cooperationjackson.org to sign up for those series and learn more. He also has a couple of really great long-form theoretical pieces. I know there's a lot of theoretical folks that listen to this program. If you go to navigatingthestorms.blogspot.com, that's where you can find a lot of these pieces. They're written in 2022, actually, and rereading them recently, how prescient and prophetic it was for this particular moment, as well as a really deep analysis of where to go. So, David, talk to us about PNLL, the People's Network for Land and Liberation, and also, how this is being built out at scale. Because I think a lot of folks think, oh, you know, growing our own food and all of this stuff. It's not necessarily political, but I think in the context that you two are building, it is absolutely so, and it's absolutely needed. So, David, what is to be done?
Well, I love the Lenin reference, what is to be done. I think Kali actually laid out really pretty brilliantly the build part of Build and Fight and what the People's Network for Land and Liberation is doing. Go to the website landandliberation.org. And you'll see this all laid out. So to be clear, what we're talking about is meeting people's objective material needs for food, for housing, for healthcare, for art and culture, because that's a human need, not merely an add-on. The point is that we have an ability to not just build lifeboats or maroon societies, but we can build genuine liberated zones. And as Kali said so eloquently, we are not waiting for the state to do it for us. In fact, we don't think government can do it for us. Now, the state apparatus can facilitate it, make it a bit easier, or they can try to make it really hard. But they can't stop us unless they kill us or lock us up. So we're coming at this, speaking of theory, from a genuine liberatory, what we call sometimes eco-socialism from below. So that's the build part. And again, as Kali says, there are people doing versions of this all over, and we want to work with you. We want to learn from you. We want to confederate with you. But we do think that the way the People's Network for Land and Liberation is doing all of them together at once to build local supply and value chains outside of the capitalist economy is what we call a special sauce. But we don't want it to be a secret sauce. We want this to be replicated all across not only this country, but across the globe. Our experiment only works if we genuinely, truly transform society and the entire social relations. And I want to shift a bit to the fight part, because I think it's really important that we not merely build these, but we have to defend them just as we must defend our community. So in the last closing minutes of this program, again, I am no advocate of the Democratic Party. I think that neoliberals are absolutely responsible for the creation of the fascism that Donald Trump represents. And we've got to put aside our quarrels and come together to protect immigrants and undocumented people from the attacks that are already beginning. We have to protect the LGBTQ community that are already being targeted viciously. We're going to have to protect local officials within the community where the Trump administration is targeting for vengeance. We're going to have to be participating, organizing boycotts. We're going to have to use all the tools in the toolbox in order to both build the new world within the shell of the decaying one, but we're also going to have to fight against these death throes of the dying empire, because it is not going gently into that good night.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I want to point listeners again where you can learn more about this effort, this analysis, and what you can do in your own communities, because it is really up to us. This is really where Think Global, Act Local is absolutely not just still valid, but absolutely necessary. Just in the last closing minutes, David, I'd like you to also talk about the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network and how we're scaling this up, how these networks are being built in a way that can actually, you know, form a new world underneath the one that is crumbling.
Well, thank you for that. I should point out that I have the honor of co-coordinating the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, and Kali Akuno is on the board of directors. So another place where we touch down. The U.S. Solidarity Economy Network is an explicit post-capitalist economic framework that understands that we have to grow past, evolve beyond capitalism. We do not believe that capitalism can be reformed. It cannot be tamed. Now, I work with people who believe that all the time, but from the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network and our framework, it is an explicitly post-capitalist. And we also recognize that we can't do a full frontal assault on the state, that we don't have the state. We have no clear pathway to take the state in any way that I can see. So instead, just as the Gramscian notion of either war of maneuver versus war of position, I'll give a hat tip to Andre Gorz and the notion of non-reformist reforms, or sometimes called revolutionary reforms. Because remember, reforms are worth fighting for. They make people's lives better. But a revolutionary reform, that the noun is still reform. It's still a reform, but it's revolutionary if it's part of an overall strategic orientation and plan to undermine the logic of capitalism, to undermine the logic of heteropatriarchy, white supremacy, settler colonial constructs. So for us, we target policies either at the local, state, or even national level where we can make some real advances. For example, building worker-owned cooperatives so that we can empower people to make things, provide goods and services outside the capitalist economy, but still within it, right? Now, but for Kali and I, you'll often hear us say, we don't want to build co-ops for the sake of co-ops, but as part of a tact, co-ops are part of a tactic that's supporting a strategy for a decolonial approach to providing goods and services. But it's not just worker co-ops. The whole notion of using community land trust and limited equity housing cooperatives, et cetera, in order to decommodify the land, even as we continue to operate under this imperial white supremacist legal system. But wait, there's more. We can promote public banking to democratize finance. We can promote universal basic income. We can and should continue to support the municipal owned energy production and distribution models. The point I'm making, Mel, is that at the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, we are committed to a post-capitalist future, but we are very pluralistic. There are multiple different approaches to that. And we do believe that and encourage folks to think about the resist and build or the build and fight framework. And if you're interested and inspired by what we're saying, for those of us who were part of the U.S. Social Forum, we are going to be convening in Atlanta, Georgia, May 2 through 5 for a resist and build convening. And if anybody is interested, resistandbuild.net, go to that website, reach out to us, let's build and work together.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for joining us on this program today. Again, we're speaking to David Cobb and Kali Akuno and the many organizations that they are both involved with. I think in this time of a lot of crises, a lot of uncertainty, and a lot of confusion, frankly, among society, I feel like, you know, and especially in the time of social media and being manipulated by techno-feudalists, talk is cheap, and we need to listen to the people with the plan. And I think you two are definitely the people with the plan. And we've been speaking with David Cobb, co-coordinator of the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network and with the People's Network for Land and Liberation, as well as Kali Akuno, who is on the board of those two organizations and also the co-founder and director of Cooperation Jackson. I want to point to the many, many resources on the web that we've mentioned today where you can find out more if you're interested in engaging with this approach that you've heard today. So People's Network for Land and Liberation at landandliberation.org. The Build and Fight Formula series starting Tuesday, February 11th at cooperationjackson.org. You can find Kali's longer theoretical pieces at navigatingthestorms.blogspot.com. And there's also the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network at USSEN, that's USSEN.org. So thank you for joining us on this program, David and Kali.
Thank you for having us.
I want to thank you. And I also want to just give a shout out again to Pacifica itself. Remember that this is a community tool. And the only way it's going to stay sharp and in this necessary time is for you to support it financially.
Absolutely. Thank you. And as we're about to go into our February fund drive. So please stay tuned to KPFK and give what you can to support community radio, especially at this time of crisis and the gutting of public institutions. So thank you again. That's our show for today. I'd like to thank our guests, David Cobb and Kali Akuno. Thanks to our regular host, Susie Weissman, who will be back soon. Executive producer, Robert Brenner. Editing and recording assistance from Juliana Gota and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can find this and other programs on the KPFK website, archive.kpfk.org. Scroll down and click on Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. More information on our guests can be found on our Facebook page, Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Pacifica Radio for Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. I'm producer-director Melissa Figueroa, sitting in for Susie Weissman. Thanks for listening.
(818) 985-5735 is the number to call to pledge your support for Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman and all the other hosts that contribute to this program. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We are taking your pledges now, and we're still taking pledges for Alan Watts. We hoped you enjoyed that segment at 8 o'clock that we had with Diane. An incredible material from Alan Watts. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. The value of KPFK is immense. So we're hoping that you appreciate what we have to offer, especially today. We have Background Briefing coming up in just moments with Ian Masters. So folks, we want you to go to your phones. And if you enjoy Ian Masters and the show, Background Briefing on Sundays on your commute, or just glad that it's back, pledge your support that we can keep it on the air. If you didn't know, we did. Well, actually, you do know that we were off the air for probably 3 days because of our transmitter. And those are things that come up like this, you know, that we need your funds and we need to stay on the air. We are listener supported. We play no ads or commercials.